I'm Greya, and this is The Climate Question, where we ask simply, what on earth can we do about climate change? Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising. Hello and welcome to The Climate Question from the BBC World Service. We're your guide to the burning issue of our time. I'm Greya Jackson.
And I'm Neil Rozelle. Today, climate migrants. Joe Biden has ordered U.S. officials to investigate the link between rising temperatures and migration.
And his climate envoy seems to have an inkling of what they'll find.
Studies warn us that hundreds of millions of people could be uprooted.
By dramatic events such as storms, floods, and fires, but also from slow-moving processes such as sea level rise and changing rainfall patterns. John Kerry says it matters for everyone.
Not only can mass migration drive humanitarian crisis, but we also know that if it's not managed well, it undermines peace and stability.
Just as we've made choices that have got us into this situation, he says we can make choices that can get us out of it.
Climate migration is coming. The question then is, what are we going to do about it?
Let's start with what a climate migrant actually is.
Okay, sure. It's people who are moving as a consequence of climate change.
Simple, right? Well, Dr. Kanta Kumari-Rigo, who's a lead environmental specialist at the World Bank, says there is a bit more to it.
People do not move for any one reason alone. People move as a consequence of social, economic, environmental drivers. But climate change is becoming a more potent driver of migration.
Putting a number on how much more is notoriously difficult, but that hasn't stopped Kanta from trying. She wrote a big report for the World Bank a couple of years back called Groundswell, Preparing for Internal Climate Migration.
We looked at drops in crop productivity, increasing water stress, and we looked at sea level rise compounded by storm surge. So what we found in this study was that just for the three regions that we looked at, which was Sub-Saharan Africa, South Asia, and Latin America, that by 2050, we could see as many as 143 million people moving as a consequence of climate change.
And that's just for three regions, and it only counts people migrating within their own country.
In comparing those three regions, what we found is that the poorest countries and the poorest were going to be most impacted. And this makes sense, right? Because it is the poorest who are mostly engaged in what we call climate-sensitive livelihoods, whether it's particularly related to agriculture, where in many of these countries, close to 50 to 70% of the rural poor are engaged in agriculture.
Let's take a closer look at what that means for one country.
The streets of the capital, Dhaka, have been decorated with the Bangladeshi national flag and festoons. For the past few days, people have been lighting candles.
Bangladesh is often high on the list of countries most vulnerable to climate shocks. It's celebrating its 50th anniversary, and our colleague Kasa Alom, whose family is from there, has made a documentary for the BBC's Asian Network about whether Bangladesh will even exist in another 50 years.
Kasa, for people who haven't been to Bangladesh and might not have a map in front of them, just where is it and why is it so vulnerable to climate change?
So Bangladesh is on the eastern side of India, just under the Nepalese mountains. It's also somewhere which has three huge rivers through it, such as the Ganges or the Padma, the Brahmaputra as well. And it's built upon so many deltas and little floodplains. In fact, about 80% of the country is really close to the sea level as well. It's somewhere that gets flooded a lot. These floods are nothing new, but they're getting more ferocious and more common as well. It's somewhere where we know climate change is happening very much right now. Where were we here? Just tell us a little bit.
So this is in the Barit. Do you remember when we went there?
Yeah.
And all had fun in there. Yeah. Do you remember that when you went fishing? Like they caught all the fish and they're all live.
The fishing.
Yeah. And then this was like...
A lot of the things that I've found throughout this documentary is that there are lots of adverse effects that are all happening in Bangladesh, whether that's sea levels rising, whether that is the temperature also getting hotter, about 1 to 1.5 degrees, and also when we're seeing a lot of people move around and having to build their houses on floodplains. So it's a country that's very much in flux.
How able are Bangladeshis to adapt?
So 22 million people still live below the poverty line. And I know about half of the population work in agriculture, including my own family, actually.
And then this was like the paddy, you know, the rice?
All the rice, and they get the cows
to walk around it
Get all the grains out, I remember.
Yeah, that's it. And then all the things. Just running around, you thought it was freedom because you lot just ran around.
So the village is called Kamal Nagar. It's named after my great-great-grandfather. And it's something that my dad is very proud of. It's in an area called Bishnath, which is in Sylhet, which is in the northeast. It floods there quite a lot. And something that really surprised me that I didn't know about is that they're having concerns about access to water. Some of the villagers, for example, in the dry spells are hoarding more water to stop others getting it. And equally, having hotter days where they're breaking 40 degrees 2-3 times a week means that there are fewer crops coming out. The rice paddies aren't as lush as they used to be. So food provision is also a bit of an issue, particularly in the monsoon season.
Bangladesh is one of the most climate vulnerable countries in the world. And so what we find is that climate change is going to really amplify some of the vulnerabilities that are already prevalent in the context of Bangladesh. So Bangladesh, by 2050, the number of people who would be moving as a consequence of climate migration would outpace those that move for other development reasons, which could be education or socioeconomic. And so, you know, the climate vulnerabilities become even more stark in the context of Bangladesh.
The World Bank estimates that by 2050, 1 in 7 Bangladeshis will be displaced. Another BBC colleague, Akbar Hussein, has been meeting some people who've already had to move. He's in Dhaka's Korail slum.
I can see a lot of children who are ages from 5 years to 10 years. They're playing football, they're playing cricket. This is a very congested slum, and more than 500,000 people are living here. It's very narrow alleyways, and there is no road inside. You cannot drive any car inside the slum. Very congested, and people are living here in a very poor condition, and I can see the houses are made by, you know, tins, bamboos, and plastic sheds. Very small houses. It's like 10 feet by 8 feet, and at least 5 to 7 people are living in a single room.
And what's life like for people who are living there?
The life is very difficult for the slum people here. If you just walk on the streets of Dhaka, you would see many people are begging. You would see hundreds of rickshaw pullers, transport workers, people just living on the streets nearby that don't have any houses to live with.
And this is what life is like for how many people, did you say?
Around 500,000 people.
Gosh. And are they all from Dhaka originally?
No, they're not all from Dhaka. These people come here from different parts of the country. They're coming from northern Bangladesh. They're coming from southern Bangladesh. They're coming from, you know, central Bangladesh. Around 500 to 1,000 people are coming here every day in search of work in this slum.
Some estimates put it as high as 2,000 a day.
It's a lot, isn't it?
It is, it is. You know, whatever the actual stat is, these are all individual stories, and Akbar's got one of them, which really brings this issue to life.
I was talking one person who is 55 years old. He has 9 members in his family. He used to live in Bangladesh's southern district named Bhola. And he was comparatively a rich man 20 years ago because he has got a sizable amount of land where he grew rice, vegetables, and some other crops. But he saw that within 3-4 years, he lost everything by river erosion. His large house, his vast cultivable land, everything went under a river. So he had to migrate to the slum, and he was telling me that he was searching after losing everything. He was thinking, how could he survive with his family? And later on, he was discussing with other villagers, and some of them told him that there is a slum in Dhaka, which is called Korail in Mohakhali. There are many people. They come here after losing everything, and if you go there, you'll get a job or you'll get something to leave your family.
What did he end up doing? What's his job now?
Now he's a rickshaw puller, and he's running on Dhaka streets every day, and he earns around $100 every month. And his son, they are also working as construction worker. They are living from hand to mouth.
So that man lost his house because of riverbank erosion. And this is a serious issue across the country. Every year, an area larger than Manhattan washes away. Up to half the people end up in these slums because of it.
It's not something I'd thought about in the context of climate change, though. So I've been looking into it, and apparently all the Himalayan snow and ice is melting because of rising temperatures, and then it's all flowing downstream into Bangladesh. And all this water is eroding riverbanks and changing the river's course. It may be that soil erosion could get much worse in the coming years.
Yes, the main reason is river erosion is the prime thing which forced people to migrate in this slum. Because river erosion is such a devastating thing in Bangladesh. You'd see every year thousands of people become homeless by river erosion. So many people, they are losing their livelihood, they're losing their land in the village areas. And once they lose everything, they have no other options left to run their life. So basically, they are forced to come here in search of work to have some, you know, food, leaving everything in the rural areas.
You've been speaking to people today in the slum. How aware are people of climate change?
People are not aware about climate change at all. They don't know about the term of climate change, especially people who are living in the slum areas. But they can realize that the nature is not behaving in the same way the way it was, you know, 30 years ago. That they can realize.
So what's the government doing about this? How are they trying to make people and cities more resilient to climate change?
The government are investing more money on research for climate change resistant crops.
Because it's not just the fast-flowing rivers that are eating farmland. In southern Bangladesh, fields are being flooded with salt water from rising seas.
Yeah, so Bangladesh scientists, they have discovered some salinity-resistant crop so that people can cope with the climate change in southern part of Bangladesh. They think that if they could invent more climate-resistant crops, people would be able to live in their areas even after, you know, climate change continues, so that they can produce crops, vegetables, and agriculture in their land.
This would help some people stay on their farms, but Dr. Tasneem Siddiqui says that won't be the answer for everyone.
I teach political science in the University of Dhaka and work on refugee and migration issues for the last 30 years.
And do you look at climate migration?
Yes, definitely. We have developed the national strategy on climate-induced internal displaced person in Bangladesh. In February this year, the Ministry of Disaster has finally adopted the strategy.
She says finally there because she first wrote the report 6 years ago. A key concept is the creation of what Tasneem calls secondary cities.
Can you just explain what a secondary city is and why it's so important in the climate context?
Because people will move for work. So you have main city like Dhaka, Chittagong, but you can develop cities in the periphery of Dhaka, greater Dhaka, and take certain jobs to those areas. And people then will move there, not here. So that's why making these other cities viable is very important, so that those who are moving, they get job, but they do get a better living environment.
So, new cities, new crops. The new cities are about making sure migrants have a decent life after they're forced to flee. The new crops are about helping them stay at home in the first place.
Do you think that's enough? Is that going to be enough to protect people?
I don't think so, but, options are very little because the country is a small country and a huge population. So it is absolutely difficult to implement any projects or any strategy when you have such a large population in place.
Tasneem says this isn't the only problem, though, and it comes down to politics.
The picture you're painting in Bangladesh is basically they need to make new cities to draw people from the countryside to places other than Dhaka or Chittagong, but that the biggest impediment to that is the fact that there is so much power already in Dhaka that there isn't the political will. What is it that's stopping these new cities from happening?
Yes, political will isn't there, and this whole interest of bureaucracy to hold on power. So it has to be political leaders should make bureaucracy to go and, decentralize their jobs. And that is not happening now. So unless these two happen, it will be difficult.
In other words, distributing power beyond Dhaka is not within politicians' interests. And without it, it's hard to see how the country's secondary cities will have the jobs that migrants want.
We've been talking a lot about Bangladesh, but it's worth saying again that it's not alone here. Lots of other countries will face climate-induced migration too. Each one will have slightly different hurdles, but they all need to reduce their emissions.
Here's Dr. Kanta Kumari Rigaud from the World Bank again.
I think what we can see is, at least from the climate change perspective, the last 6 years have been the warmest. So we're definitely not letting up on our emission pathways, and that warming continues to increase. So clearly that does exacerbate the fact that we're not heading in the right direction. So our first policy message was that we must cut greenhouse gases.
So that isn't looking so good for people living in vulnerable areas. The window of opportunity to do something is rapidly shrinking, and the stakes are high, hundreds of millions of people high. And this has implications beyond the migrants themselves. It could destabilize entire regions, run the risk of war and extremism.
What do you think is holding us back from taking more action to reduce the number of climate migrants?
I think it's dealt with by different communities. You have the migration humanitarian community, you have the disaster response, and then you have the development community. And we've all tended to sort of work a little bit in silos and have sort of slightly different remits and mandates, right? It's taken us a while, I think, to lift climate out of the sort of remit of environmental ministries to say it's a development issue that really cuts across the landscape, right? And migration suffers a little bit like that. It's a cross-cutting issue, and we really need more inclusive approaches to address it as well, because it's not something that is just about the environment. It's about jobs. It's about economic transition.
It's also about listening to the science. As far back as 1990, the UN's Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change warned that, quote, the gravest threat of climate change may be those on human migration. Today, the UN is still warning that more needs to be done to prepare for climate migrants.
But we've learned that defining what a climate migrant is tricky. It includes people running from floods, fires, and those moving for more subtle reasons like lowering crop yields or eroding soil. We've heard that in Bangladesh, the problem is acute. And while a plan to help climate migrants exists, politics are getting in the way.
For many people who have already moved, Akbar says, there's no going home.
I was talking to some women here. They said they are very eager and willing to go back to their village if, you know, they get a piece of land to build a house, a small house. They can do something or cultivate some crops in their land so that they can run their livelihood in the area. But their option is very limited. They cannot go back because they have lost everything in their area.
If you want to find out more about CASA's documentary on whether Bangladesh will exist in another 50 years, then head on over to the BBC Sounds app and search for Bangladesh at 50.
What have you seen in the climate news this week, Greya?
Well, I always like to try and give you a bit of good news to end the show. So remember last year we saw the power of geopolitics in play when Japan and China were setting net zero carbon targets. Remember China set its goal of 2060 and then Japan quickly followed with 2050?
I do.
And some speculated that this was because Japan didn't want to be seen as being behind.
Mm-hmm.
Well, this week, we're seeing the power of geopolitics again. According to the newspaper Nikkei Asia, Japan is going to announce bolder emission targets with the hope of strengthening an alliance with the US.
Any hint as to like what that means?
There's speculation around how they might meet that 2050 target. So as it stands, their target is to reduce emissions by 26% from 2013 levels, and they'd have to do that by 2030. Now, that's not very much. For context, the EU and the UK have set targets of over 50% in that same time frame.
Right.
So there's concerns that this 26% cut won't be enough if they want to get to carbon neutral by 2050. So I think we're going to hear a little bit more, maybe as early as next month, because the Prime Minister Suga is heading to the US and is said to have hopes of briefing President Biden then. But realistically, we might not have confirmation until the G7 summit in June later this year.
Fascinating.
What have you been looking into?
Well, I mean, the big news here is this. Spring has arrived outside my window, and this is what I wake up to every day, and I just couldn't resist recording a bit of it and playing it for you for just the simple pleasure of the sound.
Oh, sounds lovely. All those frogs.
It's amazing, isn't it? It's amazing. There is an arguably more important story out of Canada this week, and that is that the Supreme Court has ruled that Prime Minister Justin Trudeau's carbon pricing scheme is constitutional. This is a big story here, actually. Trudeau's government passed a law 3 years ago that put a price on carbon, and the price is set to dramatically rise in the coming years, the point being to try and get people to shift away from spending money on fossil fuels.
Mm-hmm.
This is like the centerpiece of Canada's effort to reduce emissions in line with the Paris Agreement.
But several provinces, including Alberta, which relies on oil, have challenged the law. They agreed that climate change is real, but they said they had their own policies to deal with it and they didn't need something coming out of the capital in Ottawa. They also argued that the Prime Minister's carbon pricing law infringed on their constitutional power to manage natural resources. Now, after years of argument, Canada's top court has finally said, no, a federally mandated carbon price is fine. The problem of climate change is so big, the court found, that it causes harm way beyond provincial boundaries, and it is truly a matter of national concern under the Constitution. And what it means, basically, is that the price for carbon in Canada is going to go through the roof in the coming years.
How much is it now?
It's about $40 a ton. And there's a kind of like rising scale in the coming years where it's just going to go up and up and up.
And so when you say I can buy a ton of carbon for $40, what am I actually buying?
Well, you pay for it anytime you buy fossil fuel. So gasoline, kerosene, propane, natural gas, jet fuel, if that's your thing. All of that kind of stuff has a surcharge built into it, which is based on the price of a ton of carbon. That price is set by the federal government in Ottawa. However, provinces that wish to charge more can do so. What they cannot do, and this is what the court found, is nothing.
Oh, well, there you go. That's all for this edition of The Climate Question. You can subscribe to our podcast so you make sure you don't miss a single episode and we'll appear in your pocket every week. Good to go. Just search for BBC Climate Question wherever you get the podcasts.
And if you can, leave a review. And you can also email your thoughts and story ideas to theclimatequestion@bbc.com. We check the address every day.
Alex Lewis produced this week's edition. Zoe Gelber helped with the research and Emma Rippon edited. Tom Bregnell did the mix.
And if you didn't get quite enough frog action there, here's a little bit more.
Moments that are always remembered. Moments that went unrecognized. Moments that shaped the course of history.
Adolf Kuhn was working as a mechanic when the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor.
Henrietta gave her life for medical science.
It's one of the most heavily landmined areas in the world.
Extraordinary moments in history, told by the people who were there.
The journalists wrote outstanding stories.
Witness history. Just search for Witness History wherever you get your podcasts.